If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
During this difficult time, we want to make it as easy as possible for our readers to get their copy of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed. So for the next few months, we'll deliver your favourite magazine direct to your door with no delivery charge. From today, you can save up to 70% off the shop price and subscribe from just £9.99. That's just £1.66 per issue. There's never been a better time to get your favourite history magazine delivered direct to your home. To take advantage of this unmissable offer, please visit buysubscriptions.com/historyextra and choose your magazine. Don't forget, all of our magazines are also available digitally on your mobile or tablet device. Visit buysubscriptions.com/historyextra for more information. We look forward to welcoming you. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. This week marks the 50th anniversary of one of the most nail-biting episodes in the history of space exploration, the Apollo 13 mission. That's the subject of today's conversation with Tom Ellis, a teaching fellow at LSE who specialises in aerospace history. World History's editor Matt Elton spoke to Tom to find out what exactly went wrong on the mission and how such a dramatic event impacted on the wider space race.
The first question, really, it's the 50th anniversary this year of Apollo 13. What situation was the space race in 1970?
Okay, yeah. Well, it was a very interesting time because obviously you have this kind of huge crescendo with Apollo 11 in the summer of 1969, this kind of moment that the space race has been kind of building towards. John F. Kennedy, of course, in 1961, pledges that he's going to try and sort of marshal America's space effort to put a man on the moon by the end of this decade, as he sort of iconically said. And so there's this huge, almost decade-long push in order to reach that. The American space program becomes, or the American crewed space program, I should say, becomes incrementally more sort of sophisticated. You have the Mercury program, which is sort of mastering how to kind of keep people alive in space and return them safely. You have Gemini, the next program, Jim Lovell, the commander of Apollo 13, had served in one of those missions, where you're sort of learning about how to kind of dock spacecraft, kind of transfer crews, and then you have Apollo. There are sort of various flights before Apollo 11, most notably Apollo 8, December 1968, which is kind of the key moment where it's clear that the Soviets haven't got a hope in hell, really, of reaching the moon or even kind of circumnavigating it, you know, kind of sending a craft around the moon and back before the United States. So by the time that Apollo 11 takes place, America, it's almost a fait accompli. The Americans have demonstrated that they have all of this kind of technology. Obviously, it's a very difficult thing to land on the moon, but they've conclusively proven in the eyes of much of the world that they are ahead. And then you have this kind of huge moment, Apollo 11, as a lot of people were talking about with the 50th anniversary of that. And then the Apollo program keeps going because obviously, you've invested all of this kind of the billions of dollars in this this technology, in this capability. They had to kind of eke out as many missions as possible, both for scientific reasons, but also out of a sense that, you know, the American taxpayer has invested quite heavily in this capability, so we're going to use it for all it's worth. You have Apollo 12 in the autumn of 1969, which is, in many people's minds, it's a kind of underwhelming follow-up to Apollo 11. There are some very iconic moments, you know, kind of Pete Conrad, one of the astronauts there, sort of jumping around the moon, sort of displaying this sort of very joyful sort of boyish glee at being on the moon, much more kind of jolly than Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, two very serious guys. But overall, there are some problems with the TV transmission from Apollo 12. This sort of amazing, dazzling color footage they'd hoped to kind of return didn't really work. And so Apollo 12 is scientifically very valuable. You know, it's confirming that America can do this incredible thing. But it's kind of underwhelming. You know, they've sort of already been to the moon. So by the time we get to Apollo 13, April 1970, there's a sense of kind of America being numbed by repetition about this. Apollo 13, though, has a very interesting mission. It's going to be up in the kind of lunar highlands. It's going to be in this very different sort of terrain near this kind of huge crater called the Fra Mauro. So there's this idea that even though this is doing something very new and very interesting, it does feel a bit kind of passé. And perhaps, you know, there's a hope that with this kind of new backdrop, this kind of mountainous landscape, that might kind of revive people's interest in the space program. Meanwhile, what's kind of going on with the Soviets is that they're having an absolutely dreadful time. There are in the sort of summer of 1969, you have a colossal explosion of the N-1 heavy rocket, which the Soviets had pinned their hopes of going to the moon on. One of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. And America gets to see this through its spy satellites. America's aware of this kind of horrific sort of explosion that's been caused by this rocket blowing up during a test. And that's the sort of absolute final nail in the coffin of the Soviets hoping to kind of get their crewed lunar program off the ground. They time a sort of robotic probe to try and sort of land on the moon at the same time and hopefully maybe return some lunar soil samples at the same time as Apollo 11. Doesn't work. It crashes into the moon. There's a lot of worry in America that this that there might be an infinite, you know, this absolutely tiny chance that this Soviet lunar robot will crash into Apollo 11. Anyway, it doesn't happen. It just crashes harmlessly. But that's another kind of humiliation there. At this time, even though the lunar program is officially still going ahead, there's a real sort of sense of gloom and doom within the Soviet space effort. You know, kind of cosmonauts are watching their American counterparts, the astronauts, walk on the moon, having this kind of series of lunar missions ahead of them. And they're sort of watching from afar, sort of seeing their own program in turmoil. Meanwhile, publicly, the Soviet space program is saying, we were never interested in going to the moon. We're just interested in space stations now. Space stations are actually a much more important and worthwhile endeavor than, you know, just going to the moon for a few hours. So publicly, they're trying to make the best of a bad situation. But and some Americans actually do buy that. People like Walter Cronkite, the American news anchor, sort of later reflects that, you know, oh, the Soviets were never in the race at all. Well, they were. But it's this sort of very odd time then, to kind of cut a long story short. You have, you know, kind of America's achieved this incredible victory, but now there's this sort of anticlimactic kind of what next sort of mood. And at the same time, America's Challenger is sort of reorganizing and sort of reassessing itself. And there's also kind of NASA has to think about what's it going to do next, and also is it going to be allowed to do these kind of huge projects that it wants in this sort of post-Apollo world. So that's when Apollo 13 kind of takes place, against that sort of backdrop.
What do we know about the crew of Apollo 13, and what was their mission? What was their objective?
Okay, sure. So it's a very interesting crew, because the sort of initially those guys weren't meant to be on that mission. NASA kind of crew allocation at this time is this really kind of strange, you could almost say kind of corrupt system, in which you have this former Mercury astronaut, a guy called Deke Slayton, who is grounded because of a sort of very slight heart irregularity. But in the early days of the US space effort, that was far too much for him to be allowed to go into space. So as a consolation prize, he's allowed this sort of leeway over choosing the kind of negotiated process by which you choose crews. And so Slayton initially wants an alternative crew with a guy called Shepard, another early American Mercury astronaut leading it. So the idea was that Shepard had done this very brief flight early on in the space age in the Mercury program, and now he's finally going to get his chance to go to the moon. You know, kind of a lunar mission is, and sort of commanding a lunar mission is the top prize if you're in the astronaut corps, which has grown quite large by this point. Anyway, various sort of things happen. Shepard is recovering from an ear operation. There's also concerns that he's not really ready. He's been out of the astronaut game in terms of training for a rather a long time. And rather than kind of bring in a new commander, the situation is that you'd sort of bring in a new crew. So this crew, which initially comprises Jim Lovell, Fred Hayes, and a guy called Ken Mattingly, is sort of brought in because these guys are trained, they're ready. Lovell, particularly, very experienced. He's sort of been on Apollo 8. So he's been on Apollo 8. He's been on kind of other missions as well. So he's already done this incredible, incredibly dangerous and lengthy journey from the Earth to the moon. Apollo 8 circumnavigated the moon. You have Fred Hayes, who he's a former fighter pilot. This is his first space flight. So Lovell is the commander. Then you have Hayes, I believe, was going to be the lunar module pilot. He was going to be the guy who sort of takes the lunar module down to the lunar surface. And then lastly, you were meant to have a guy called Ken Mattingly, but he was exposed to rubella. NASA is kind of incredibly cautious in terms of health risks. The idea of if someone has even sort of comparatively minor or sort of prosaic illness, they're not going to be allowed up in space, because you're essentially in this kind of very small enclosed environment, breathing all of this recycled air. It's just a hotbed for kind of germs to multiply. So Mattingly is grounded, and a guy called John Swigert, Jack Swigert, is assigned. Swigert is also a rookie, and he's seen as a bit of a kind of curiosity in the astronaut world, because he's one of the, I think he's the sort of sole, at this time, unmarried astronaut. And the media goes to town with this. They kind of create this idea that he's this kind of amazing ladies' man. Now, lots of the astronauts had sort of less than perfect marriages. Particularly in the early program, there's a lot of stories about kind of astronauts having affairs and sort of all of this very hyper-masculine sort of hijinks that they get up to. But Swigert is sort of dubbed the astronaut with a girl in every airport. But it's also, it's quite difficult kind of integrating him into the crew because he's sort of come in late. They've trained with Mattingly. They've really got to know Mattingly. It's such a, even if sometimes crews aren't friends, I mean, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin work together because they had a job to do. But the idea that they were kind of best friends, absolutely not true. Some crews do become very good friends. Some crews do become very close. But you do have to work incredibly closely with these people and incredibly sort of stressful and draining situations. So the fact that Mattingly was swapped out and you have Swigert swapped in, that was going to be a difficult thing. Obviously, they kind of bonded together as a crew and they worked extremely well together. But beyond all of this, I think kind of the people designing the spacecrafts might have seen, you know, sort of Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff puts it, you know, the astronaut's just another component. He's part of this big, you know, is he in the American system at this time? The astronaut crew is entirely male. But they see the astronaut as perhaps another component that can just be slotted in. But actually, existing and working together in this very stressful environment causes a lot of pressure. And so there has to be an incredible amount of teamwork in such an enclosed, claustrophobic space. So, yeah, you have Lovell, who is the commander, former Apollo 8 veteran. You have Hayes, who's a rookie. And then you have Swigert, who is the backup to a backup. He's the guy who's kind of drafted in comparatively last minute. So Apollo 13's mission is quite different from Apollo 11 and Apollo 12, which both land on these terrain called the Lunar Seas. So the Sea of Tranquility and the Ocean of Storms. And those are the kind of dark patches that we see when we look up at the near side of the moon. Apollo 13 is going to be landing on the lunar highlands, which is, if you look at the moon, you see the kind of brighter patches. Those are higher sort of up areas of the moon. It's going to be landing very near to the rim of one of the gigantic kind of craters on the moon, the Fra Mauro, which is named after a Venetian astronomer, a Venetian cartographer, I should say. Anyway, they're going to be landing there, and quite a lot of their experiments are going to be to do with lunar geology. One of the things they're going to be doing, or they were planning on doing, they didn't get the chance to, was to drill into the lunar surface and sort of see what the composition of rock is like beneath the surface. They were also going to set up some experiments to try and sort of study things called solar winds, these kind of charged particles that are related to sort of solar activity. They were also going to set up just sort of a range of other experiments to try and see whether the whether you could sort of say that the moon has a kind of atmosphere of its own, no matter how thin. So sort of detecting a lunar atmosphere was another of their sort of jobs whilst they were there. So there's always a kind of, I mean, most of the work that they're doing up there is kind of geology, learning about the moon, because the moon's geological history is closely connected with the early geological history of our own planet. And so sort of trying to look into the origins of the moon, the origins of the Earth, is geology is always kind of an important thing. And then also taking advantage of that sort of vantage point out of the atmosphere to do sort of, experiments with regards to astronomy and space physics, so these kind of solar wind things. So they had a lot of work to do, which sadly they didn't get any of it done. But their the mission that came after them ended up taking their sort of landing site and also conducting those experiments. So the work was done in the end, just not by Apollo 13.
Mm. This is one of those stories that's shaped inevitably by the fact we know how it ends. But what factors led to the disaster that we know about, and how soon on did things start going wrong?
Okay, well, there was a huge investigation afterwards, and it's found sort of that these problems were there much sort of long before kind of the craft launched. But in terms of the mission, things are going sort of comparatively smoothly for essentially the first kind of day or so. So they launch at about 1 p.m., just after maybe 1:15 Houston time on Saturday, April the 11th, 1970. they then sort of, you know, change their course in order to enter this course that will bring them to the moon. On Monday, April the 13th, 8:24 p.m., they begin their last TV transmission. So the idea is that you do several kind of TV broadcasts. By this point, because people are kind of getting a bit bored of the space program, they've sort of seen this, you know, this sort of thing many times before. This isn't really going to be carried live. Rather, they do this broadcast and then they sort of send the footage to news sort of channels, and they can use that however they want. Anyway, they sort of begin that last TV transmission about 8:24, and then under an hour later, you have this problem with their second oxygen tank. So what happens is that there's a command that's given by the ground to stir up the oxygen tanks. So essentially, the spacecraft needs three things in order to kind of do its job. It needs water, it needs oxygen, and it also needs hydrogen. And those gases are kept at cryogenic temperatures. They're kept at this hypercold state, this sort of weird slushy mixture. It's not quite a solid, it's not quite a gas. And from time to time, in order to kind of take accurate readings of how much of these gases they've got left, there'll be a decision to kind of stir the tanks using these fans. So ground control in Houston gives this this kind of signal to Swigert, stir the tanks, and he does so. And this is a kind of routine thing. It's something that kind of happens at various intervals throughout a mission. Swigert flicks the switch. However, there is a problem with a damaged switch within the tank. And essentially this causes a sort of, it becomes heated. This causes an explosion, and there's this very violent explosion that rocks the spacecraft. The crew feels the explosion and the kind of aftermath, the shudder of it. That's when we kind of get Swigert saying, hey, we've got a problem here. And then Lovell gives the iconic phrase, which is, Houston, we've had a problem. They've been in space for a while, but this is still the early part of the mission. They're on their way to the moon. So that's when this kind of this occurs. It's quite early on in the mission, but during a period of time when actually the fact that they could even do this TV transmission just before, that shows that there's not much important stuff going on. That's when you schedule in these kind of publicity tasks, which are, you know, maybe not scientifically important or engineeringly important. They're incredibly important in terms of building a rapport with the people who fund your program, the American taxpayers and the sort of global media to kind of spread this this sort of message. So even though it's a very important propaganda task, it shows that in engineering and sort of flight terms, there's not much going on. It's meant to be fairly, fairly sort of... Yeah, it's meant to be a fairly uneventful stretch of the mission. But then you have this problem where the second oxygen tank explodes, and then the problems just cascade from there.
Something that really interests me is not only the fact that obviously mission control then have to scramble to get things sorted, to get this fixed, but that some of the techniques they use to help solve the problem are really lo-fi, really seemingly shoestring, if you like. Can you talk us through those?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there are all of these kind of problems. It seems like when they solve one, another problem emerges. The first big problem they've got to do is, well, what happens now? They decide pretty quickly, we're not going to the moon. The plan now is to go back to Earth. They have to decide on the route to do that. Once they've decided on that, they then have to think the main issue is conserving fuel. So they start getting very creative in terms of which systems they power down. They decide that the best chance for survival is if they use the lunar module, this absolutely tiny cramped module called the Aquarius. This absolutely cramped module called the Aquarius, it's meant to house two people for a very brief period of time, but it ends up having to house the entire crew. They sort of flee into there, they power all of the systems down. There's all of these lengthy negotiations about which systems do you power down and for how long. And essentially for the astronauts, it feels probably like they're flying blind. They've been trained on these systems. In many respects, they're computer programmers as much as they are pilots. So, but then, as you say, yeah, you have these kind of very lo-fi, ingenious solutions to some of those problems. So the idea of powering everything down, powering down these systems to just allow you to kind of limp back to Earth is one of them. But another thing is that the oxygen, the carbon dioxide scrubbers, these kind of devices that are meant to sort of take out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere of the craft and sort of purify it, they pack in. And so they have to kind of construct an adapter. Basically, you have a team down on Earth sort of working out how to do this with only this sort of bizarre scavenger hunt. To sort of use a cultural reference, it kind of feels like a kind of something from Art Attack. They kind of get given this, you know, this kind of flight manual cover. They've got this kind of plastic bag. They've got kind of items of clothing like a sock and just lots of duct tape. They sort of have to cobble together this carbon dioxide scrubber. So in the Odyssey, the carbon dioxide scrubbers come out of these square canisters. But in the Aquarius, which is where the crew are, they're in these cylindrical holes. So they have to get this square thing to fit into a circular hole. And so they have to create this kind of bizarre adapter. And if they don't do that, they're going to get carbon dioxide poisoning, which will mean that they won't be able to kind of make decisions. They'll get kind of steadily more lethargic and sleepy. They'll get confused. They won't be able to kind of sort of understand the commands that are being given. And then gradually they will be poisoned by the carbon dioxide in their own breath. So even though this thing feels ridiculous that they're having to kind of, you know, essentially duct tape this sort of weird adapter together, if they don't do it, there is a real chance that even if the carbon dioxide doesn't kill them, that they'll make an error that will kill them. So I think kind of that's the most kind of famous or the most kind of notable one. But I think a big part of it is just that they're also having to kind of at one point navigate using stars rather than kind of the computer, because all of these systems have been powered down. To a great extent, they are kind of flying blind, and they're having to sort of reassess all of this training that they've done on simulators and learning this computer system inside out. And they have to kind of sort of essentially kind of learn this new way of kind of getting home.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I hope that people kind of remember that this is something that really happened. This is a real story. This is a true story of ingenuity, of teamwork, and of sort of this sort of human connection that an entire planet worth of people felt towards these three individuals.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
You mentioned earlier the importance of team dynamics. How horrible a time were these guys having, and how did tension start to fray between them, if it did at all?
Okay, so they're having an absolutely horrible time. It's getting incredibly cold in the ship. They're in the lunar module that they're traveling in, because environmental controls in terms of keeping them warm, a lot of that system has been powered down. So it's sort of the temperature is plummeting. This eventually gives Hayes, he sort of starts becoming very ill towards the end of the mission, just from this kind of essentially exposure. He's in this incredibly cold environment. There's one point where they consider actually putting on their sort of space suits, some of the sort of suits that they would have for the early part of the mission, their pressure suits. But then they think, no, we'll just start sweating too much from being in there, and we'll become more dehydrated more quickly. They're having to ration all of the water. And the other thing is that they just don't sleep for much of the mission. The flight surgeon, who is one of the people on the control desk, is constantly saying, you've got to let these guys sleep. These guys need to sleep. If they don't sleep, they're going to start making mistakes. And, you know, there's going to be even more problems. But the crew are adamant. They're saying, no, we're not going to sleep now. We're not going to sleep now. There are some moments, I think, kind of within the crew, that there's no kind of, you know, punch-ups. Sort of they aren't kind of attacking each other. I think obviously there are points where they're being kind of very short and very brusque with each other, but they do know that they have to work together to survive. I think kind of when you have had problems within a spacecraft, there are some Soviet missions in the late 70s, early 1980s, where you have these guys up there for months at a time. And they sort of start to get on each other's nerves. There's one case in the early 80s where one cosmonaut becomes very offended that another cosmonaut doesn't like his poetry. And so there's this kind of very awkward atmosphere in this craft with this sort of very small crew. Apollo 13, it's not so much that. I think it's more kind of dehydration, sleep deprivation, constant, you know, kind of low-level terror that they're not going to make it back. And this occasionally leads to some irritation with the ground. I mean, at one point, Lovell takes off the sensors that are attached to him, because he just sort of really resents the fact that the ground can see how stressed he is. They can see his heart rate, and they're uncomfortable. They've been on for kind of days, these sort of things essentially taped to his skin, and he just rips them off. And obviously that causes a big sort of kerfuffle on the ground. They're worried, like, kind of, why have his sensors stopped working? Have they stopped transmitting or something? But that is kind of one aspect of irritation, where occasionally there is some irritation between kind of the ground and the crew. But to be honest, I think the kind of terror of the situation and the fact that these astronauts have been chosen because they are extremely calm, eerily calm, collected people. That's something that kind of you get when journalists, and particularly some more countercultural figures. There's an Italian writer called Arianna Fallaci, also Norman Mailer. They sort of see the astronauts as these almost robot-like figures, because they're just so straight. Now, obviously, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but that's how they kind of come across, because they've been chosen because they are so calm and collected. So it's an absolutely miserable ordeal for them. I think particularly for Hayes, who is feeling very ill, you know, not sleeping for days at a time, this constant low-level fear, becoming incredibly dehydrated, and you're sort of gradually succumbing to illness from the cold, as well as that brief period where they're worried about kind of carbon dioxide poisoning. Yeah, it's a horrible time, but the fact that they managed to keep it together, I think, really sort of testifies to their characters, really, because, yeah, it's an unimaginable sort of situation to be in, that much pressure, and with all of those sort of unpleasant environmental factors. I mean, spacecraft are horrible things anyway. People who've been in space say that, you know, the main odor that you smell in a spacecraft is kind of excrement. Like it's not a pleasant place to be in. You're essentially like you're sharing, people have likened it to this, you're sharing a porta cabin with someone and you have to perform every bodily function in there. So it's an unpleasant environment anyway, in this kind of recycled air with this constant low level sort of hum of all of this machinery. But add into that cold dehydration and terror, and it just gets even worse. So the fact that they were able to come out of it, I think, really speaks to them.
What factors were most important in the eventual lining them up for re-entry, and how touch and go was getting back to Earth?
Well, kind of there were a lot of factors came together, because essentially you have all of these multiple problems, and a big issue is how they are going to conserve fuel in order to do a few really key bursts of their kind of engines in order to correct their trajectory and enter into kind of new trajectories in order to get back. There is a problem towards the end where there's a kind of this piece of technology called the helium disc on the Aquarius that bursts, and that causes a kind of minor explosion. They're worried that that's going to sort of deplete fuel further. Luckily, it's survivable. The sort of big fear is that they're not going to be able to have enough fuel to essentially enter the correct trajectory, because there's a worry that they might just end up slingshotting between the moon and back, or that they will enter Earth on an unsafe trajectory. And even once you've kind of got back through the atmosphere, you have to worry about things like the parachute apparatus of the craft landing. So this kind of parachute helps it in the kind of final stages. It's kind of got through the atmosphere. It's sort of been wreathed in flame as it goes down. But in 1967, you had an example of a Soviet cosmonaut, Vladimir Komarov, who is killed when his parachute doesn't deploy correctly. It kind of gets twisted. There's an issue with the parachute, and he is slammed back into the Earth. And just this, the force of that, and the kind of the kind of impact on that has on him, his body, is just horrific. So even though the Soviet craft would land on, they would sort of be parachuted down to land America, they're parachuted down into the ocean, that could still happen. The force of kind of hitting the ocean could, kill the astronauts. And particularly in that very final stretch, one of the scary things is that you can't communicate with the craft. As you sort of pass through the atmosphere, they can't reach you. There are sort of key moments, one when you're kind of on the sort of far side of the moon, another when you're sort of re-entering the atmosphere, where you can't reach the ground can't talk to you. And so usually this kind of bubble of, there's this hubbub of chatter, and in those moments things can get very quiet in mission control, because there isn't sort of communication happening. Obviously people are talking, they're sort of reading the readouts they have, but information isn't really being transmitted. And that, I think, just right at the end, it's essentially right until they hear the crew come back into contact that they sort of know this ordeal is finally over. But yeah, there's just all this fear about kind of having enough fuel to make it home. And then when they're getting back home, it's like, well, is this ship in a fit state to be able to re-entry? Nothing like this has ever happened. There have been some close calls in space before, but nothing like this. This is really unprecedented. Obviously they've trained for all these eventualities, but not really an eventuality like this where you have so many different things going wrong.
We opened by talking about the fact that the American space program was waning in terms of public interest. This is all incredibly dramatic, this mission. Did it revive interest in the space mission in any kind of meaningful way?
I think it does, certainly for a kind of very brief period of time. And I think also it's one of the most memorable sort of missions that NASA does in the Apollo program. People remember Apollo 11. There is some memory of Apollo 8 as well. It kind of brings back this iconic photograph, Earthrise, of the Earth rising over the horizon of the moon, this sort of really eerie picture of how sort of beautiful but kind of insignificant the world is. And then Apollo 11, of course, this sort of triumphant moment. Apollo 13, though, is the other thing that people remember from the Apollo program, because as NASA says, it's a successful failure. It's this very, kind of filmic, even the mission before. There have been multiple films that have been made about it, but it's better than any of the kind of space rescue films that are out there at the moment. There are various space rescue films that have come out in the late 1960s. None of them can top this in terms of drama. And I think also it does something which NASA really struggled with, and I think which kind of handicapped NASA, which was NASA was really, it really struggled to kind of translate what it was doing into meaningful human terms. And Apollo 13 is just such a human story. It is about three human beings who have to kind of work together in order to survive. And it's also a story about kind of this vast network and effort of people who are trying and using all of their ingenuity and all of their intellect, just all sort of towards this one purpose, which is helping some fellow human beings survive. So there's an immense kind of outpouring of relief when they get back. Like, suddenly these guys are celebrities again. Because, you know, just after the moon landings happen, when people are interviewed the next year, people can't remember Neil Armstrong's name. But with Apollo 13, there is this sort of huge outpouring of relief. I mean, you have prayer vigils organized by the Pope. Nixon is sat up all night watching it as well. You have kind of messages coming in all throughout the world. The Soviets are offering to help. Even kind of some small landlocked African countries, I think it's Burundi, offers to help as well. All of these kind of offers are pouring in. And I think kind of that has a really, I mean, Nixon as well uses this for his own political benefit, kind of this goodwill that it's created. And it does sort of, there is a brief moment where kind of this story is just such a huge story, such a dramatic story. It's quite hard to kind of sneer about it. But the issue is that around this time, NASA is going through this very difficult transition. Its budget is cut massively. President Nixon says that he wants space to kind of take its place as a sort of, in terms of national priorities, take a more normal place within America's national priorities. So it's no longer going to be this kind of huge, all-encompassing effort to beat the Soviets. Actually, space is going to be lower down on the government's priorities now. NASA's budget peaks in the kind of late 1960s, before Apollo 11, a couple of years before, and it never recovers to that level. NASA's hoping that it's going to be able to send people to, it's going to be able to build this reusable space shuttle, this huge space station. It's going to go back to the moon, and then eventually it's going to go to Mars. None of that ends up coming true, except for the space station, which is kind of kept on in this very reduced vision from what had been initially proposed. And the space shuttle that is eventually created is this sort of weird compromise between NASA, the Nixon administration, and the Bureau of the Budget. Which kind of, it is very, a very impressive piece of technology when it eventually arrives, but it's nowhere near kind of what NASA hoped. And NASA has to kind of console itself with this. There's also a space station called Skylab that the Americans kind of go up to in the sort of early 1970s. And Skylab's incredibly impressive and a really fascinating story, but essentially, by this point, the public interest has already kind of turned away from space. NASA's already kind of lost the people. And also, crucially, it's lost kind of political backing. And so space kind of recedes. You have kind of the Skylab missions, and you have, in 1975, a cooperative mission between the Americans and the Soviets, the Apollo-Soyuz test project. But even that, this kind of idea of, which Apollo-Soyuz is an amazing story and very inspiring in many ways, but at the time, it's kind of seen as this political stunt. It's sort of there to kind of promote this foreign policy that Nixon and then Gerald Ford are doing of reaching out to the Soviets. But yeah, there's a sense that the public have turned away, the money's dried up, and Apollo 13 is seen as this amazing event. But it also kind of underscores, you know, look, here are the risks of this thing. Here are the risks, and are the rewards really worth it? So even though Apollo 13 is this kind of amazing, inspirational story, it's almost too late to really kind of reinvigorate American interest within the space program.
What was the impact of this whole mission on the Soviet space program, if there was any?
Okay, well, it's kind of difficult because by this point, the American and Soviet programs have diverged quite considerably. Early on in the space program, they're marching in lockstep together. But what kind of happens, the main initial thing is that the Soviets are really irritated by this mission because it's been sort of scheduled for various reasons, but the Soviets see, they think it's been deliberately scheduled to take attention away from April the 12th, which is Cosmonautics Day in the Soviet Union. That's where they kind of honor Yuri Gagarin, the first cosmonaut, first person to orbit the Earth, and his comrades. So they see it, oh, well, they've just timed this thing to kind of take interest away from Cosmonautics Day. Even more irritatingly for the Soviets, they think this has been, or there's indications that people in the Soviet government think this has been deliberately timed to detract attention away from Lenin's 100th anniversary. So there's some irritation there. But actually, once they start encountering problems, the Soviets don't gloat about it within their newspapers. They report on this as a sort of unfolding story in fairly neutral terms. They're not saying, as they had before, you know, this shows the kind of recklessness of the imperialist capitalist war machine and its space effort. You know, it doesn't care about human life. They report in fairly neutral tones. At the same time, the Soviet government reaches out to the Americans and says, if you need help, we can provide it. They can't rescue the Apollo astronauts. That would be impossible. They wouldn't be able to get something ready in time. And also, they wouldn't have been able to dock their ships and exchange crew. They have different atmospheres. That's one of the reasons that's given for the Apollo-Soyuz test project, this joint program, where they say, well, we need some kind of space rescue capability. And Apollo-Soyuz is designed to start investigating that. But there is some American suspicion, though, at these Soviet offers of help. Actually, the Soviets send these fishing trawlers, which are, you know, inverted quotes, widely believed to be kind of Soviet spy ships, very near to the splashdown recovery sites. And the Soviets say, look, we're just sending our trawlers there in case the guys need some help. We'll sort of reel them in. But they're seen as kind of, you know, loitering in a sort of slightly unseemly way. Anyway, what happens after this? In 1971, the Soviets experience a space tragedy. Their first space station, there's been an incredibly successful mission by three cosmonauts to a space station called Salyut 1. Incredible mission. The world's first space birthday is celebrated. One of the cosmonauts has a birthday party. He's given a slice of fresh onion because he's not had any fresh food for the duration of the mission. He can't believe it. He, you know, kind of, he's talking on television about how wonderful this onion is. I believe that's kind of that mission. But anyway, it's a recurring theme, this kind of gift of sort of fresh vegetables being smuggled in by cosmonauts. Anyway, they have this kind of amazing mission. These three guys become national heroes. There's a sense in the Soviet Union, it's like, we might not have got to the moon, but hey, we've accomplished this incredible space station. People have fallen in love with these three cosmonauts, and they travel back to Earth when the recovery crew opens their spacecraft. They found that all three cosmonauts were dead. And their spacecraft had depressurized during re-entry. And it's horrific, just kind of as a way to die, it would be extremely painful. And that is just a real blow. It's sort of, some people reflecting on it have said it's like kind of the impact of the Kennedy assassination, just this kind of gut punch that these three confident, charismatic cosmonauts are just killed in such a sort of senseless way. So the Soviet program is still experiencing all of these horrific difficulties at the time. But in kind of 1970, around this time as well, kind of 1971, sort of slightly after Apollo 13, you do get the sort of first glimmers of space cooperation with Apollo-Soyuz. The two sides, even if it is for very political reasons, even if it is for this very propagandistic idea, they do start sort of realizing that, you know, rather than compete with each other, maybe there needs to be some form of cooperation in space. And that's very tentatively, and it takes essentially the end of the Cold War for it to come, but that's the first tentative steps towards the International Space Station. And the idea that we have now, where you sort of have countries working together, they're obviously, that doesn't solve everything. There's still, you know, I mean, lots of tensions in space between America and China and Russia at the moment, but you do kind of get these steps towards a more internationalized, less sort of gung-ho competitive system in this era.
How would you like 50 years on people to see this particular mission and its place in history more generally?
I guess with Apollo 13, I hope people would kind of continue to remember it. I hope people remember the mission itself, not just the Tom Hanks film, which is a very good film, but I hope that people kind of remember that this is something that really happened. This is a real story. This is a true story of ingenuity, of teamwork, and of sort of this sort of human connection that an entire planet worth of people felt towards these three individuals. And I'd hope that they kind of remember that. I'd also hope that they remember, you know, that after this happened, you know, America kept doing things in space, that space sort of racing, space competition, space cooperation, it didn't end. The story doesn't end in 1969. The story keeps going. And what we need to do is we need to kind of, in a way, I'd say, think about the space race, but we need to maybe de-emphasize it a bit. We need to think about other stories, kind of stories of cooperation, stories that go beyond simple kind of national programs, and think about kind of how does technology kind of flow across borders? How do people communicate their technology across borders? Those kind of things. So thinking about kind of the space race being important, but also remembering that, you know, we've now had 50 years since the end of the race to the moon. So kind of thinking about this sort of broader story of humanity in space and kind of rivalries and cooperation in space, not just this kind of pure story of getting to the moon. There's a lot of other stuff out there, I think, is what I'd hope people would be investigating in 50 years' time.
That was Tom Ellis. Tom has written a feature on the Apollo 13 mission for the April issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now and also includes articles on Bloody Mary, The Spies Who Inspired James Bond, and The Declaration of Arbroath. If you're interested in this subject, then also check out the second series of the BBC podcast, 13 Minutes to the Moon. That's available on BBC Sounds now, and it goes into more depth about the mission and features interviews with some of the people involved. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman.